You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today on the program, we learn about the latest research and advances in sports concussions and how we diagnose and treat these injuries. A decade or more ago, a concussion was viewed as a week-to-week injury, something you would bounce back from. Now we know that the cognitive effects can last for weeks or even months. My guest today is a neuroscientist researcher looking for new tools to enable sports medicine specialists to determine when athletes are ready to safely return to activity. My guest today is Dr. Pat Belgowan. He is a director of cognitive neuroscience at Laureate Institute for Brain Research and an assistant professor of community medicine here at the University of Tulsa. He and his colleagues are conducting a novel brain imaging study which will assist physicians in the diagnosis and prognosis of athletes' brains after concussions. And he joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Belgowan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
How has our understanding of concussions changed over the last decade? When we look back 10 years ago, this was not nearly the issue it was, but I think having to do with the military in the Middle East and IED accidents and the amount of brain injuries there, all of a sudden we're starting to really focus on this in sports. And our understanding of concussion is very different than perhaps a decade ago. How has it changed?
Well, there's been a much larger increase, particularly for the reason you brought up, which is the military. So the IEDs produced, there's a blast, and you know, you see it in the movies, there's like these blast waves that they'll always show if they show the blast in slow motion. Well, those actually exist. And when they hit the soldier's brain or head, it causes their brain to slosh inside their head. And that's basically what causes any type of concussion, is your brain sloshing around in your head, because your head's a hard bone and your brain's a very soft sort of jello-y thing, and it's floating in fluid. And so if you move your head, your brain jostles. And, you know, a blast wave is going to make the brain stretch. And the blast waves will hit it multiple times because there's multiple rings in the blast wave. It's kind of like dropping a rock in a pond. You see the ripples. And what happens was that these soldiers would, they'd become disoriented, and they had a lot of problems. And then they started to find out that these soldiers also had a lot of more psychiatric problems than ones that were in blast injuries.
And a lot of times we wouldn't refer to them as traumatic brain injuries unless it was absolutely debilitating, you know, to the point of coma or severe cognitive impairment. We tend to lump a lot of different brain injuries under concussion: mild, medium, severe.
Right. So that's the trick. So the nomenclature is a little bit strange in that severe is really severe, and it usually involves a skull fracture. You're unconscious for a half an hour or more. There's bleeding in your brain. And so a mild concussion, which is what most people get in sports or in a car accident, or, you know, even the soldiers around, you know, unless they're too close to the blast, well, it'll be mild, but it's still causing brain damage. It's mostly defined by any change in cognitive state. So you'll have people will change the way they're thinking, the way they're feeling. And often it's reflected in, you know, several classic symptoms of, you know, you see it in the movies all the time. They forget what they're doing, where they are, you know, they become irritable and confused. They don't know what they're supposed to do. And that's if you're in a war, that's a serious problem. If you're in a sports field, it's also a problem, but it's a little more serious in a war. So we try to classify what we're studying. What my group studies is mild traumatic brain injury. And that's because we focus on sports-related, because it's a little bit easier because we have access. We can get access to players right after they get concussed. Whereas a soldier, you know, they're getting concussed in, you know, thousands of miles away. And there's no way that we can do our, you know, we do brain imaging, neuroimaging research. There's no way we can get access to them within, you know, a month. And so it's what we're trying to understand is the pathophysiology or the changes in the brain chemicals that happen while you're concussed.
Well, I can remember not too many years ago, even a sports concussion, you would get a concussion and the coaches are saying, oh, he'll be back in a couple of weeks. Nowadays, there's nobody making those sorts of comments. Maybe they'll be back. Maybe they'll be back in a month. Maybe they'll be back next year. I mean, we've really changed a lot of how we deal with concussions.
Right. And that's one of the main purposes of the research group and the sort of, we have a multi-institutional group that involves TU and OU. and that we're trying to educate people about, coaches and players and parents in particular, about that, you know, concussion's a serious injury. You need to think that it's your brain, and your brain is really who you are. You know, your brain is what makes you understand jokes and think things are funny and, you know, be quick and, you know, just in general.
Tells your legs to move.
Right, exactly. It does everything. And I think in the old days, the problem was that your brain is a really complicated machine, and it can do a lot of things. And the really cool, I study it, so I think it's really cool. The really cool thing about your brain is that when it has some damage, it still performs really, really well, right? If your heart has a little bit of damage, right? you're in trouble. You're in trouble. And so what we're trying to get people is to understand that even a little bit of brain damage is something you need to relax.
Of course, the one thing about the brain is, as I keep reading, is that it is so resilient. When it does have an area that's damaged, it'll try to make new connections around it. It will do a lot of really amazing things to keep function occurring.
And so part of what we see is that they can function as well as they do is that there are redundant systems. You know, it's kind of that way. If one part of it goes down, you can still function. It's what allows you to go get food and be afraid and do all the things you need to do in survival if you were a caveman. But now, you know, we do even more complicated things. But it's the redundancy that really allows you to be able to get back up. So, when an athlete gets concussed, he's a little bit confused. You'll sometimes see it on the field, and they won't know what to do. Or, you know, they'll report that they're going to the wrong huddle or they're just lost out there. But they can once the play starts, they still perform relatively well. They kind of know what they're supposed to do.
Well, you know, you remember it was not too long ago that a player would be, quote, shaken up, you know, as you would see on a sports broadcast. He would go off maybe for a quarter or two quarters, and eventually he would come back in the game. He would convince the coach, or coaches would be convinced he was all right. As we look at that in hindsight, I think nowadays, anytime you suspect a brain injury, a concussion, they don't come back into the game.
Right, and the interesting thing is the way it's worked is that right now the NFL is the most strict about that. And as you go down, the strictness kind of fades away, which is kind of sad because the younger you are, the more vulnerable you are. The TU professor Ron Walker here wrote the law. Oklahoma is one of the states that has a concussion law. And basically it says if you're in a secondary school association athletic event, the OSSAA event, which is high school sports and junior high sports, if you get a concussion, you can't come back until a medical professional has cleared you to come back, and particularly a medical professional who has experience dealing with concussions. The sad part, the thing that we're trying to get across is that, and trying to develop rules in these other leagues that aren't OSSAA, that they don't have oversight on them, you know, some of the little football leagues, baseball leagues.
Yeah, peewees. Yeah. Uh-huh.
They don't have this oversight, and so I think it's critical to start the conversation with these leagues about, let's just follow the state law. So right now I'm working with, there's a lacrosse league, so the Tulsa Lacrosse League is just beginning to implement the same law. So we're just, you know, following the rules. It's a little harder because you have to rely on parents. So if you're at the University of Tulsa, you have a absolutely fabulous athletic training professionals helping you out, identifying kids that have concussions and testing them. Well, you don't have that at little league football, and you don't have that at lacrosse. So you got to rely on
Are
parents.
Brain injuries just as likely in those situations? Because I think the little kids, how much stress, power, and, you know, that's the whole thing with high school, increasingly high school, junior high sports, there's, you know, they're going full speed, bam, into each other. You know, you don't think of it the same thing on the little league and kids, but is that the case?
And there's been two recent studies that showed that it is the case. So these kids little kids that are like 8, 9 years old can hit 100 G forces.
Wow.
And what happens is why they're more vulnerable is it's all about neck strength. So the concussion doesn't happen. It's not just the strike to the skull. That's what the helmet protects. And that's why kind of helmets don't really protect you from concussion. They can protect you from skull fractures and cuts and stuff. But the concussion itself is from your head jostling around. So kids with weak necks, and you can watch them if you watch peewee football, the helmet kind of already jostles around on their head. So when they smack each other in the head, it's boom, you know, it's like a bobblehead. And that's how concussions happen.
Wow.
And unfortunately, kids are poor at telling you the symptoms, right? Sometimes they don't really know that they're confused, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the sad thing about little kids.
Well, one of the things that has come into our lexicon in the last decade, again, is this PCS, post-concussion syndrome. Again, as I was mentioning, a concussion was something that lasted a few weeks and you went back to your activities, you went back to work. If it was at a car accident, if you were a professional player or college athlete, you sat out a few weeks and boom, you're back in there. Now all of a sudden we're understanding PCS. Now what exactly is PCS? How do we diagnose it? What are the symptoms?
Well, so in about 10 to 20% of people who get a concussion, and the rate goes up the more concussions you have, but the first-time concussions, 10 to 20% of people will have long-term effects that can last months. And so there's been some classic examples of that in sports. So Justin Morneau, I'm a Twins fan, so my Minnesota Twins, he was out for about a year and a half after one concussion.
Wow.
I'm forgetting the name of the Pittsburgh hockey player, but there's a hockey player in Pittsburgh who's a star and he's been in and out. And basically what it is, no one knows who gets it or why they get it, but it's just prolonged symptoms. And they're not always there, but they'll be keyed by, generally they'll be keyed by activity. So the athlete takes a little bit longer, maybe 2 weeks, they recover, and then as they start activities again, the symptoms come up again. And so what you'll see, to make tests for that, trainers and doctors should do this also, is, rather than just saying, oh, you don't have symptoms anymore, you're good to play, what they'll do at a school like University of Tulsa here is it's basically a stress test where they'll make you sit on a bike, get your heart rate up, because increasing your heart rate will cause the symptoms will start coming back.
Yeah, and blood's flowing, yeah.
Yeah.
And into the brain and out.
Headaches, you get light sensitivity again. Mm-hmm. And so I work at the Laurier Institute for Brain Research, and our main mission is to relieve the suffering of psychiatric illness. And so people always ask, well, why do you study concussion? And that's because across all levels of traumatic brain injury, the number one complaint is psychiatric symptoms. And so it's not just headaches and light sensitivity, but these players also go into a psychiatric state where they'll be impulsive, and that's what gets them in trouble.
Irritated,
yep.
Memory loss?
They have memory loss. They're depressed.
Mm-hmm.
They become anxious, and those things really affect their lives. And the trouble with those, one of the unique things about athletes relative to other traumatic brain injuries or concussions, so if you get a concussion in a car accident, in the old days, what would happen is there's this idea that you'd be malingering, which just means that you're kind of extending your symptoms in order to get paid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so people took that malingering, the history of malingering TBI from car accidents, and started to apply it to athletes. Well, it turns out that athletes are actually the opposite. They don't want to malinger. They don't want their symptoms to last. They want to play. So they underreport their symptoms usually. And so our challenge is to try to figure out, particularly with things like psychiatric symptoms, which have no objective measure. I can't look at you and tell if you're sad or you're depressed or anxious, right? I have to ask you. And if you don't want me to know, you won't tell me. And so that's a real problem. And so that's one of the basis of what we're trying to do here in Tulsa, is understand the psychiatric symptoms. And so we can, when a kid comes in with a concussion, we can say, hey, here's a test. Let's give it to him. Hey, I think you still have some psychiatric symptoms. Let's wait a little bit longer.
We'll talk about that research in just a moment. My guest today is Dr. Pat Belgowan, the Director of Cognitive Neuroscience at Laureate Institute for Brain Research. He's also an assistant professor here at the University of Tulsa in community medicine. And let's talk about your research. You're doing these imaging studies where you're looking at athletes as they come into your system, athletes after they're concussed, and I assume athletes down the road from concussion, and seeing changes in brain activity. Tell us a little about the research.
Right. So one of the challenges for the concussion is if you go in, you'll note that your doctor generally won't scan you. If you have a lot of symptoms, they'll give you a CT scan, or a CAT scan, people call it, which is just as looking if your brain's bleeding. Because mm-hmm. if your brain's bleeding, that's real trouble. But most concussions don't cause that. So, and if you do an MRI, a clinical MRI shows no problems in your brain. And so that's been the history, and that's really been the problem with diagnosing it. And so what we've done, and since the mid-90s, there's this thing called functional magnetic resonance imaging. And the cool thing about functional magnetic resonance imaging is that in a non-invasive way, we can look at your brain while it's functioning, what it's doing. And it's basically just looking at changes in blood flow and the oxygen levels in it. And so what we're trying to do is apply that to looking at concussions. Classically, functional imaging looks at a task. So I'll give you, I'll show you a picture and then see how your brain reacts to that picture, you know, or I'll show you a sad face and a happy face and compare how you can process sad and happy faces. But the challenge with any patient group is that they're bad at it. So I could give these guys a memory test, right, in the scanner when they're concussed, and yeah, they're bad at it. And guess what? Their brain function is low, right? Not a surprise. But we have another method that's been developed, and probably in the past 10 years is where it's really been blossoming. It's called resting state functional fMRI. And all you do is you stare at a crosshair, and you don't do anything. You know, we tell people to think of nothing in particular. And what we're really able to do with that scan is then we can probe. Your brain works in systems. And so we can probe these different systems. So we can probe your emotional system, and we can probe your the impulsivity system, and we can probe your memory systems, right, and see how they're functioning while you're actually doing nothing. And then we can follow that as you come across. So what we do is we've worked very closely with the University of Tulsa. They've given us unprecedented access to their athletes. And the athletes, of course, volunteer and have really done a great job in volunteering and being cooperative. Because what they do is they come in, we try to get some of them before they're concussed, but generally what we get them when they're concussed, and we try to scan them a day or two after they're concussed. It's kind of a tough state to be scanned in because MRI scanners, you know, it's non-invasive and there's no radiation, but it's loud, right? Yeah. and they have headaches. So, yeah. So it's good for it's tough for them to sit in there, but they do a great job of it. And so we scan them a day or two after, and then we bring them back in a week. And we chose a week because a week, you know, about 2/3 or 3/4 of athletes will have symptoms relieved, mostly relieved. They'll tell you that they're relieved. And then a month. And that gets you back up to about, you know, 90%, 80 to 90%, where, you know, the PCS, the post-concussive syndrome people aren't relieved yet. But everyone else is pretty much, they feel symptom-free and report symptom-free. And then again, we bring them back in a year.
What have you been finding? I mean, are we finding that the effects of the concussion last a lot longer than we expect?
Yeah, so just behaviorally what we found is, I mean, so we have a really nice, one of the keys to research is that the players can tell me things and I can't tell the trainers, the coaches, so it doesn't affect their playing time. So right. They can be a little more upfront with us and they'll tell us their symptoms a little more, and that's what we're finding, in particular with psychiatric symptoms. So when they're talking to trainers and coaches and stuff, what you'll find in most athletes is
I'm fine. I'm ready
good.
To go.
Yeah, I'm not sad. I'm not anxious. But when they come here, we're a professional psychiatric research institute, so they're being interviewed by professional psychiatric interviewers, and we find out that they are a little, you know, they're not horribly depressed usually or very anxious, but they are mildly depressed and anxious, and that lasts much longer than we thought it was going to be. So we still see it at a month out. And what that suggests to us is that your brain isn't completely healed yet in those subjects. And so you should probably wait a little bit longer. And that's what we're trying to develop is, can we find markers? Because we're also using blood markers of inflammation. Because anytime you get hurt, you have inflammation. The challenge is that this inflammation is in your brain. And these guys in general, if you take football, for instance, any sport really, but football is the most obvious one because it's a collision sport, and you have bruises and bloody fingers, and that's
all
inflammation.
You're going to have inflammation all inflammation up from head to toe.
Right. So what we try to do is find the inflammation that's brain specific. And the only real way, the best way to do that, of course, is to get spinal fluid. But we're not going to do, no athlete's going to say, yeah, give me a spinal tap. That'd be great. So we're trying to, bust through the noise and find. And I think we found one particular inflammatory marker that we think it's high. The importance of it is that it's also high in patients that have mood disorders. And so we see it high in the athletes who have higher mood scores, and it's following their mood rating scores as they come back down to normal. And then we can look at the brain connectivity of this emotion processing network, and we can show that it's starting to stabilize.
So is it possible to think that there might be a simple blood test that can tell you when an athlete can safely go back into action down the road?
Yeah, down the road. That's the long-term goal, right, because you don't want – you can't throw everyone in an MRI.
Right.
But what the nice thing about the MRI is it tells you the brain health. You can get an estimate of brain health and correlate that with the blood markers. And so, yeah, so what the long-term goal would be, here's a blood test. We see these levels, which suggests that your brain isn't quite recovered yet, and you should probably stay out.
Now, what about the actual MRI imaging? Are you able to tell a lot from that, or is it just a matter of whether the brain is bleeding at all?
Yeah, no, it's so the function, that's what the functional imaging gives us. So if you're, these systems that we have in our brain are always talking to each other, sort of, you know, use it or lose it. So they're at a low level, they're always ready. That's one of the cool things about your brain is you're always ready to respond because you don't know what's coming in the future. And so they're always talking to each other, and we can probe that low-level talking. And what happens, what we're seeing happen in concussed athletes in general is you get this dampening of particular systems, especially the systems that are involved in what's something called working memory, which is just what they have to do is remember things for a very short period of time, right? So we give them a sequence of letters, and is this letter the same as the one you just heard, right? And that's a very specific task, but they're really bad at it when they're concussed.
Yeah.
And that's a very well-known brain circuit. And so what happens is that circuit goes down, and then even when they're not doing the task, and then we can follow it as it recovers back up. And so I think we're going to get really new insight. We have some really interesting findings about the psychiatric emotional processing networks, and what we're seeing is and the ones who are having the more psychiatric symptoms, we're seeing an area called the subgenual ACC, which is just a classic area for depression, and it's just not functioning quite right. So which suggests just that they're not able to regulate their mood as they normally do, and then it just recovers. It hopefully recovers back.
What about people who are completely asymptomatic after concussion? You know, they feel fine. They don't seem to have the emotional markers that we would think for a post-concussion. Is there still some damage that we can see on the MRI that doesn't seem to show up?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the challenge because it's a spectrum, right?
Right, right.
Within mild, it's within concussion itself, it's still a spectrum of severity. And generally, there are people who you know, are within a day or two are just fine. But it's also that's their own self-report, and we're not always great at reporting. So, I mean, I had a concussion just last year. I got hit in the head with a baseball. And my wife told me, you're just wrong. But I seemed right. I thought I was all right. But I think it's this lack of you become a little bit lack of awareness.
Self-awareness.
And, and so we're trying to, what we really need to do is develop better tests, because right now diagnostic tests suggest that even though people think they're better, they're really not. So there's a lot of really interesting studies about measuring people later on, and they're still not quite back to where they were, though they think they're perfectly fine.
What about the diagnosis, say, in-game for sports medicine specialists? How is this changing? How would you hope that they would change their reactions? Say, you know, a guy takes a big hit, he comes off, he can repeat the letters back, he knows where he is, but maybe he has a slight concussion.
Yes.
So, are we getting better diagnostic tools?
Yeah, so we're trying. There's a big boom in this right now, and it's not all evidence based, which is
unfortunate.
Yeah. but what you can do. So what we're doing with like the lacrosse league is there's apps. So there's an international sports association that every couple of years meets, and they develop, you know, this is what concussion is, and this is how you should test for it. And they actually have a free app you can download. It's called the SCAT 3 now. It's a SCAT 2, I think, is the app still, but SCAT 3 will be coming out soon. And it just asks a series of questions, and it also does a balance. There's some balance tests. So that's one of the most sensitive measures is balance. So they can't, because it's also one of the things they can't fudge either, right? So they're going to lose their balance.
So we're talking putting them on one leg, arm on the head,
yeah,
arm on the side or something?
It's like you put, you know, one of the tests, for instance, is you put your hands on your waist and you put your feet in front of each other, and then you do it eyes open, and then you do it eyes closed. And when you do it eyes closed, they'll start to wobble, mm-hmm. right? And you measure how bad their wobble is. And so it'll tell you if it suspects. So these apps generally say, is a concussion suspected or not? But in general, you know, what the law says, if you're an OSSAA,
That's junior high and high school in Oklahoma.
Right, the secondary Oklahoma Secondary School Association, Athletic Association.
Yeah.
If you're suspected of having a concussion, they need to keep you out, right? And so that's the level of diagnosis we want to get to. But trainers are great at this, right? I mean, I had no idea. When I started doing this, I had no idea how hard trainers' jobs are. It's not just fixing them up afterwards. They sit there and they monitor during games.
Oh, they're watching. They're watching every player, every play.
Yeah, they're watching every play, trying to figure out who's hurt and let's pull them off. But you know, a lot of schools don't have that, and clearly these rec leagues don't have that. So that's when you need the parents. And what we're trying, you know, one of the goals of this forum we're having is just to educate parents and coaches and say, look, you know, you're better off playing it safe. Keep your kid out for a little, you know, for it's a game, right? Don't risk your brain for a game. Right. Is basically the message, and if they're fine, they're fine, and it's going to be okay. It's, you know,
we've talked a lot about football, but what about other sports? I mean, everything from soccer, where the head is part of the action, and you know, you see head collisions quite a bit, especially at the upper leagues. You mentioned lacrosse, basketball, which is increasingly, there are collisions between two players. Is the athletic training nature pretty uniform between a lot of these sports as far as being able to see head injuries?
Yeah, so at the professional and college level, it is. At the high school level, you get a lot of variability, and there are even high schools that they can't afford athletic trainers.
Football, they can,
yeah,
but say
other sports, they can.
Yeah, your non-revenue sports, no. Yeah.
And so the reason that people focus mostly on football is because it's among the highest rates of concussion, and I grew up in Minnesota, so hockey's king there. You know, football's you
play. I would imagine there are a few there too.
Yeah, you play football to get in shape for hockey up there. So, and hockey has a really high rate too, also. But you know, in Oklahoma, there is hockey, but there's not a lot of hockey. So we focus mostly on that. But soccer. So soccer has, especially women's soccer, and we're not. There's research is just starting to come out. We're actually developing a project to look specifically at women's soccer and collegiate soccer. And in all these projects, we're trying to go down in age also, but that's, again, the education of trying to get people. Part of what we're doing is trying to get people educated and that it's important to participate in these types of research. But, yeah, women's soccer, what you see is that women seem to be more susceptible to concussion, and they seem to have bigger, their symptoms seem to be a little bit worse. Hmm. And one of the hypotheses, again, is neck strength.
Hmm. Dr. Bell-Gowan, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Neuroscientist Dr. Patrick Bell-Gowan, a researcher at the Laureate Institute for Brain Research and an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Tulsa. I spoke with him about post-concussion syndrome back in May of this year. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.